Hello, this is Kathy Hart, host of the Health First Radio Show. Today we have some really great guests on. The first one is Diane Gayhart, and she's the author of Mindfulness for Chocolate Lovers. And then in our second half, we have Cheryl Hannah Nicholson, and she's going to be talking about her integrative kinesionics practice. But first, here's Alan with the Health First News.
Though weight loss surgery can do wonders for your waistline, a new study suggests it might also reverse subtle damage to your heart. The research included 38 obese patients who had weight loss surgery and 19 obese patients who were on the waiting list for weight loss surgery. At the start of the study, 58% of patients in the surgery group had subclinical heart disease, which means changes to the heart and its function before actual heart disease starts. In 82% of those patients, subclinical heart dysfunction normalized 6 months after surgery. But subclinical heart disease worsened in 53% of the patients on the waiting list during the same period. The findings were presented last week at the European Society of Cardiology annual meeting in Vienna, Austria. Imagine a blood test that could spot whether you're aging too quickly. New research suggests it's not the stuff of science fiction anymore. The scientists analyzed plasma, the cell-free fluid part of blood, from more than 4,200 people between the ages of 18 and 95 and found a link between 373 proteins and aging. Study senior author Tony Weiss-Corray said, "We've known for a long time that measuring certain proteins in the blood can give you information about a person's health status, but it hasn't been appreciated that so many different proteins levels, roughly a third of all the ones we looked at, change markedly with advancing age." He's co-director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at Stanford University in California. The study was published December 5th in the journal Nature Medicine. Daily low-dose aspirin might reduce your risk of dying from cancer, particularly if you packed on a few extra pounds, researchers say. Taking aspirin 3 or more times a week is associated with a lower risk of cancer death, as well as death for any reason, a new study reports. Aspirin's protective effect appears particularly pronounced among people who are overweight, those with a body mass index of 25 to 29.9, the results show. Low-dose aspirin reduced overall cancer death risk by 15% and all-cause death by 19% among more than 146,000 people who participated in a cancer screening trial conducted between 1993 and 2008, the study authors said. The new study was published online December 4th in JAMA Network Open. Rising levels of cholesterol among young adults is strongly tied to long-term odds for the number one killer, heart disease, a new study finds. The new global study involved data on more than 400,000 people from 38 different trials. Their health was tracked for an average of more than 13 years, but some were followed for up to 43 years. The researchers looked especially at the effect of blood levels of all forms of cholesterol except good HDL cholesterol. Reporting December 3rd in The Lancet, the investigators found that regardless of age, higher levels of this non-HDL cholesterol were tied to raised odds for heart disease, as well as fatalities due to heart disease. The effect was especially pronounced in people who were young when their cholesterol levels began to rise, probably because their cardiovascular systems were then taxed by cholesterol for many years to come.
Diane Gayhart is an accomplished practitioner, professor, and researcher of psychotherapy, and she's also written a delicious new book called Mindfulness for Chocolate Lovers. It's a lighthearted way to stress less and savor more each day and have a sweeter life. So welcome, Diane.
Thank you so much.
It's good to have you on our show today. After all this work in your practice, what caused you to write such a beautiful book?
Well, I've actually been teaching mindfulness for several decades now, and like many people, when they teach mindfulness, one of the easiest exercises is actually an eating meditation, which is traditionally done with a raisin. And as I would fly around speaking, I would carry those boxes of raisins around, and they would get crushed often when I arrived. And so I'm like, what could I bring? And I've always loved chocolate, and I was eating chocolate one day, and I said, you know, you can mindfully eat chocolate, and it's a lot of fun. It's very interesting. And so I started teaching with it just because it was easier to travel with. And I've actually found it's actually a more challenging a meditation, and it has a lot of really practical implications for everyday life. And so it actually was a much more useful meditation in some ways than the traditional raisin, or certainly more challenging. And I certainly found people much more interested and willing to try mindfulness with chocolate than with some other techniques.
So you had a captive audience once you had wrapped up chocolate.
Absolutely.
Can you give us a little bit of background research about the benefits of mindfulness for our stressed out, overstimulated society?
Oh, my goodness. Well, there has really been a quickly growing body of research over the last four decades about mindfulness. And one of the reasons for that, of all the psychological techniques we use, mindfulness is just such an easy one to isolate and study in a very specific way. And if you listen to all, I mean, both, there's a long list of physical as well as most psychological disorders improve with mindfulness. And the reason for that, you know, sometimes I feel like a snake oil salesman when I start, you know, yes, this will cure everything. And the reason for that is that most of the both physiological as well as psychological problems we have in the 21st century really have to do with an overstimulated stress response. That's the fight, flight, freeze response that we have. And so what mindfulness does is it significantly improves our ability to shut down that response, especially even consciously, and to just turn it off. And when that happens, both our psychological symptoms, you know, get better, as well as our physiological. Basically, any disorder that you have that is exacerbated by stress, which is most of what we are afflicted with in the 21st century, gets better with mindfulness.
Hmm. What are some of the popular myths that people that come up with that they're finding happiness in the wrong places?
Well, we certainly have a lot floating around in our society, which actually exacerbates our stress. And I think one of the most common one is if I only had more money, I would be happier. And the research is really kind of stunning around this, in that it's really around between 100 and 100, 250,000 per year, happiness really levels off. And if you make more money on that, and of course it depends a little bit where you live, where you fall on that spectrum, but your happiness levels actually begin to go down if you make too much money, which is, I think, very surprising. But many of us think that once we have more money, we're going to be happier, and that's just not the case. Which kind of brings us around to a second closely related myth, is that more pleasure will bring us more happiness. And this relates to one of my favorite psychological terms called the hedonistic treadmill. And what that refers to is this principle of habituation. So if you get a lot of stimulation of the same thing, and I'm going to give an example here in a minute, your brain stops registering that, and so you need more and more and more. And so the example I give is, you know, my kids would love to have ice cream every single day of the week for dessert. And so if I give them ice cream every single day after a few weeks, you know, that's not special anymore. And so now to make something special on Saturday or for a special occasion, you've got to add the whipped cream and the nuts. And then, you know, that's still not special enough anymore. So now we got to add more, you know, a cookie topping or, you know, some gummy bears or what. So you can see how if you constantly have whatever you find pleasurable, after a certain point, it no longer registers in the brain as pleasurable. So you really need to space it out. You know, another good example is your favorite song. If you play it over and over again, it's amazing. After, I don't know, a few days, weeks, all of a sudden you can't even stand to listen to it anymore, right? And it's the same thing. So you need to space out your pleasures. Otherwise, your brain just habituates to it, gets used to it, and it tunes it out. And you either need more of it or it just stops bringing you pleasure. So, and another really common one is fulfilling your dreams, whether it's your dream job or, you know, finding the love of your life or having a child. You know, all of these are big dreams. And it's true. They do give you a boost in happiness for about 3 months. And after 3 months, your happiness level kind of goes back to its default level. And so what they actually find is more highly correlated is pursuing your dream. So while you feel like you're pursuing your dream in a focused way, you know, that working towards something is actually when we measurably are more happier than after achieving that big goal. Another fun one is that, all of these kind of make sense. Another one is, you know, around emotion. So it kind of seems logical that the fewer negative emotions we have, you would think those people would have fewer, more positive emotions. But the research, again, shows otherwise, where you can have negative emotions, And but the bigger correlation is not so much in the negative emotions to having more positive. It's being able to have several in-the-moment positive emotions each day, such as mindfully enjoying a sunset, being present when you're talking to your friends or family or loved ones. Those, stringing those types of moments together are what really brings us happiness. And just a gender note on this one, that women tend to have more positive and more negative emotions in a given day than men do, so there's a gender difference on this. But in general, it's those in-the-moment, small, positive moments, taking time to mindfully experience the daily good things that are happening to us is what we correlate, actually, with real happiness.
So it's being right here, right now, and being conscious of it.
Yes, and doing that as often as you can on a given day, rather than getting what you want, rather than having big dreams fulfilled, that people who are measurably happier than others are able to really appreciate a lot of those small pleasures. We have all those sayings, we say it all the time, but do we practice it all the time? And that's really one of the reasons I think there's been such interest in mindfulness, is it's the natural antidote to kind of our own overstimulated world. It reminds us and kind of almost reteaches us how to be in the present moment, even in just small little sips, you know, of small little moments throughout the day. That's what we are finding is actually correlated to someone who feels happy more often than not.
Okay. And so really, it's creating the habits that bring us back into the present moment rather than being way there in the past or in the future, being here.
Absolutely. And I think you said the magic word there. It's creating the habits. And so much of experiencing happiness comes down to the habits that we cultivate in our daily life. And the more conscious we are of that, the more often we are going to be experiencing happiness.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in fact, the Buddhists talk about happiness being a habit, not just a mood state. We often think of it in the West as a, you know, emotional state that we're in. But the Buddhists say, no, happiness is a set of habits that you cultivate to learn to be in the present moment, to be able to move up and down with the ups and downs of life, and recognizing that that's what life does. There are good times, there are bad times. It's okay. You move through those, you accept it, and you recognize that the problems are there. Step up to the plate and try to solve them as best as you can with the resources you have, with the knowledge you have in that moment, knowing that, you know, it's going to ebb and flow, and that's okay.
Wow. What's the first thing you do when you jump out of bed so your mind doesn't just get carried away with the busyness?
I'm a tea drinker, so man, I do have my tea, and it's a mindful moment for me, and that, you know, and you can take any one of your, you know, daily rituals and using that to help, you know, pair it with being mindful. And so I always try that first sip of tea. I do like to drink out of a pretty teacup. I make my cup of tea, and I just notice the steam rising off of it mindfully, and it's beautiful every single time. And then I try to have that first sip or two just to quiet my mind, experience it, taste it. And it's a very simple thing, but as you develop these little tiny habits, that's why they don't have to be big. It's one of the reasons, it's one of the things I talk a lot about in my book, is that I think most people think mindfulness, you know, you have to set aside 20 minutes a day. I mean, that's a whole lifestyle shift for many of us. It's these little moments, sipping your tea, you know, making a minute, 2 minutes, 5 minutes, you know, to practice a mindfulness meditation. It's those little habits that you do on a daily basis that really create the shift that results in long-term measurable differences and your overall level of happiness.
Hmm. Diane, we're going to go to a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about some of the common pitfalls and challenges on this path to greater happiness.